White Hot Magazine of Contemporary Art.
This is a candid interview with Al Diaz, also known as Samo, conducted by New York City painters Brian Leo and Rick Prohl. They discuss the exhibition that Diaz has curated at Howl Happening in New York, entitled City of Kings, A History of New York City Graffiti, which runs from 11/19/22 to 1/29/23. Also, Al Diaz is known for his interactions with Basquiat, the Samo graffiti tag being a tag that Diaz and Basquiat shared. I'm sure a lot of you have already read or seen films or heard information about that history. This is Noah Becker from White Hot Magazine. I hope you enjoy the following broadcast. Special thanks to Rick Prohl and Brian Leo and Al Diaz for joining the podcast today. Enjoy.
It's you guys that are angry, but I mean, I was angry for a long time too, but
all right,
but anger is energy.
This is Brian Leo sitting here with
Rick Prohl.
See, it's me.
And Al Diaz.
That's me.
So, Al, you were talking about your talk yesterday at the Howl Part 2 of the.
Well, it wasn't my talk. I hosted it, but but I wasn't mediating or facilitating or talking. I answered one question, but it was a little bit of. I mean, you know what it was? It was very real in that you saw who the original graffiti guys were and what they were like, because it's a big cross section of guys from the Bronx, Harlem, Brooklyn, and then later Queens and Uptown Manhattan. So
yeah.
it's like anything. It's like a microcosm of the world. You know, there's always. There's people that are articulate, others that are not so articulate. Some that are angry, some that are nostalgic. So it was a good sense in a good cross section. So it was a good example of who the early graffiti guys were in that sense. But the dialogue was a little all over the place.
Just to fill listeners in, Al. Along with co-curators Mariah Fox and Eric Felisbret, curated City of Kings at the Howl.
Howl Happening.
Howl
Arts, yeah.
Located on First Avenue. And
no,
also,
6 East 1st Street.
Oh, of course.
6 East 1st Street.
And 255 Bowery.
And 250 Bowery, which is their more swanky location.
So the show is called City of Kings. There's two parts. Rick and I attended last week's show. At the Howl.
Right. Yeah.
The 250.
Yeah, we were there.
Some cool.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's that. That was the show at 60s First Street was more of that's the timeline. That's the more like didactic kind of educational.
Yeah.
It's a timeline. So
yeah,
it discusses how graffiti, which was created by a bunch of kids from the inner city kids, and I mean like between the ages of 12 and 16, and how it became what it has become, you know, which is a huge international phenomenon. But it started at that's really its roots. It's like Julio 204.
First year?
What
was
the
conception? Is there one?
1967 is 67. when people start to notice this guy Julio 204, a guy who's writing his name, you know, in a very nice handwriting. With his street number, so that's a new thing now, right? And that's where
that's
like the prototype for the
all the 204th
Street all the way. Wow. That's like Inwood, right?
Yeah. And then Uptown. Tommy
183 was a little later. He saw that what Julio was doing. There was a handful of Greek kids up in Washington Heights, and they started writing their names.
Right.
But Taki, and when Taki was they all went to the same school. There were a bunch of Greek kids. Phil T. Greek, Greg 69, and Taki 183. The more notable of that group of Greek kids.
So these young teenagers, they're they have roots from the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico.
Well, exactly, because Washington Heights, which is the spawning ground for New York graffiti culture, was a mixed neighborhood. There was a lot of there was Greeks, there was Cubans, some Dominican, not as many. Now they call it Little Santo Domingo now, but back then it was more mixed. There was Puerto Ricans, Cubans, and Irish as well.
What's also kind of fascinating is, I mean, this goes back. Aren't there stuff on the Parthenon or something? Greeks.
Well, yeah,
would call it.
Yeah, I mean,
graffiti.
Yes, no.
No, I mean, it.
There was graffiti.
Yeah,
graffiti was found in Pompeii.
Right,
and,
right.
Cave drawings.
It's interesting, though, you know.
From your show, I think.
No, because it really has a history of.
Right,
from
but
the beginning.
Well, we're not doing the entire history of all human beings writing on the walls, but it's about New York, not name and number, right? Yeah, right.
What I thought
because
was,
you can take. We would need a football stadium worth of wall space
no.
to show that.
Yeah. But we have to. Yeah, that's a great acknowledgement. But I think we can start from the Kilroy, because I didn't know what Kilroy was until like one day
World War II. Kilroy was here, yeah, and then if you read about Kilroy more deeper, it goes back to World War I, and it's attributed to a cartoonist in England somewhere.
Okay, yeah.
So that it's like it has roots,
and then
and
the
some people
in Massachusetts,
right.
But like the graffiti or the right tagging Kilroy was here for the soldiers, just like. Was almost like a game for them after a while to just like say like we're in this.
It was also a collaboration. It was a collaboration because everybody was doing it. You know, it's like almost like.
Right. So that's pretty fascinating and amazing. I think I saw a video at your show with Flint mentioning Kilroy.
Yes. Yeah.
And maybe he even being inspired by that.
Of course, I think we all in some. Even if it's a subconscious, on a subconscious level, we're influenced by that. Because I know I knew about Kilroy as a kid, you know. I mean, I had heard about it or whatever. But he was definitely kind of, he was already in our heads, you know. The phenomena of Kilroy was here, was in our heads.
All right, so Talkie 183 gets a write-up in the New York Times in 1971.
Right.
And
That was probably catalytic for like kids. Seeing that if you spread your name around, you'll be famous, you know, because like having your name in the New York Times to a kid is, you know, like you've achieved some sort of fame, right?
Yeah.
And it was, yeah, so the title of that article was Talkie Spawns Pen Pals.
Okay.
And he certainly did a lot more after that, you know.
And then the shift from the walls to the trains.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, first, yeah, because I think that happened pretty quickly. But Hooligan 204 was predominantly. I mean, some people have seen it in basements, on walls up in the Brooklyn. I mean, Washington Heights, Inwood area. You know, the rock at the end at North Manhattan that has the big C for Columbia University. When you cross the Broadway Bridge, it goes. There's a short bridge where the number one train goes over from Manhattan to Marble Hill, which is now the Bronx. There's a huge boulder where the East River or the Harlem River joins with the Hudson. And there's somebody climbed up there and saw a Julio 204 tag up there.
Oh, wow.
So he was definitely more on the street. And the early writers in New York City and other cities like Philly were based in the street, you know, like that's where the parks where the kids hung out, buildings, you know, hallways. I remember we these were rundown areas that you know, back in the 70s, early 70s, late 60s. And but then it quickly, I mean, people going to school, you know, you're going to school uptown or, you know, a few stops away from your actual house. So you bring it onto the subway. And the subway served as almost a internet back then, because a kid in Washington Heights marks a train that's going to go all the way to Far Rockaway. Now, a kid in Far Rockaway sees this and says, oh, wow, what's this? And it sparks his interest. And that's how graffiti spread throughout New York, was because of that.
So kids like Futura, Daze, Lady Pink, Crash John Matos, Lee Quinones, Fat Five Freddy, like they were tagging trains.
Well, Fat Five Freddy was not really a big graffiti artist. He was exactly. he was a promoter. So he was let's not Warhol, don't put him in the same category as Lee or Crash, who actually painted trains, you know, and okay. Futura, those guys. Fab Five was like the Don King kind of character, you know, like he was a promoter.
There was something about that show, like Fab Five Freddy and Lee Quinones did in Rome, that also.
Well, he promoted it, but okay. And it was called the Fab Five, which is that's a really tricky little thing there. Fab Five was referring to the Fabulous Five, which was Doc 103 or 109. I forgot his number. Doc, Mono, Slug. Lee and who else? One other guy. But it wasn't that Freddie was not a big graffiti writer.
Okay.
He, you know, he did that one thing with the soup cans, and I believe Lee did the drawing for him.
Oh yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. So he wasn't. And then he somehow he promoted that show, and then gave himself the name Fab Five Freddy.
All right.
But he was because he was promoting the Fab Five.
So, all right, Freddie Braithwaite.
What about Scene? Do you remember Scene?
Scene was all those guys were like later generation. They started writing a little later than, but oh. Scene was from I think from the West or North Bronx. Yeah,
I'm not sure.
He's very successful. Scene, yeah. Extremely successful. He's out on the West Coast.
He's blocked some work.
Oh yeah,
I know.
Excellent.
He's been very
right.
Cool.
I think you mentioned that last week. Actually,
yeah,
I didn't mean.
He's been pretty supportive.
Yeah.
Then the Times Square show. You're in the show.
No, I'm not in the show.
You're not in the show?
I'm not in the Times Square.
So this is like misinformation I picked
that's
up on the
absolute, web. Like, so absolutely not true.
Wow.
I was playing in the 80s. I was playing music. I was not doing any. I mean, I did some notebooks and some like collage stuff for myself that I really didn't share much, but I still have that stuff, and I'm actually doing like some.
Had been established by
SAMO was in 1978, and yeah. SAMO lasted a year and a half, if that.
Okay.
And it was me and Jean-Michel, but Jean-Michel kind of took it as because we had a little press behind it, he kind of jumped on it and said, I'm SAMO, kind of like trying to promote himself. It was only local fame. It wasn't international. The entire world didn't know what the fuck SAMO was.
I didn't know it was only one and a half years.
It was a downtown thing.
Do you remember
SAMO? It started in January 1978.
Specifically, yeah.
And by December 78, we got an article in The Voice, which is completely. That's interesting because they reissued the article, but they shifted the photograph that they took and cut me out of the photograph and just highlighted Jean-Michel. But if you read the article, which if people just look at fucking pictures, you will see that it's Al and Jean. Somehow they just wanted to, because the cult of the personality, where it's more exciting just to make it about Basquiat because he's such a big name. And this way, anybody else that was.
I don't mean to interject because I could be wrong, but don't they do that to LA 2 also?
Yeah, we were speaking about that last week as well. Yeah,
you know what I mean.
LA 2 probably, but I think that LA 2 did some underhanded things to kind of like piss people off. So that's really where. And I don't think that everything that Keith did that was along with LA 2. I think there was a certain period.
I think you yourself mentioned that you're going to meet up with Clayton Patterson later today.
I know. I just dropped it off before. That's why I was late, because I had to drop off something.
I think he's like a big advocate of trying to get recognition for Angel. What's his name? Angel Ortiz?
Angel Ortiz, yeah. Well, Angel is like, LA2. You know, I mean, he's kind of in a sorry kind of situation because he's still strung out, and you know, and he's burned a lot of people, so people don't trust him. You know, people that have done him try to look out for him, and he just burned them, which is what happens when you're strung out. So, you know, whatever. I don't know what to say about
that.
Yeah,
let's go back to SAMO for a second, if you don't mind. I mean, when I met Chris Parker, who you know well,
yeah,
back Chris. In the day, Yeah, Chris always would share some anecdotes from his experiences with Basquiat, and Rick has experience with Basquiat, and so do you. Maybe like you guys can just share any anecdote that you would. Maybe, you know, doesn't have to be positive or negative, just whatever comes to mind. I mean, Chris Parker talked about like Basquiat sleeping on the floor during his scene in that Jim Jarmusch movie, Permanent Vacation, his dance scene or whatever. And he talked about Basquiat sleeping in a box and like, and I don't know, also, I don't know, the hustles or the hustling that he had done or something. I mean, it's just, if you want to go that in that direction, if you want to talk about the same at all.
Well, it's kind of unavoidable.
Well, I mean, I don't know about the box thing. I never saw Jean sleeping in a box. I think that's from that movie.
I don't know. Chris actually said that.
No, he used to always hang out. He would always end up sleeping at like the Albert and the Earl Hotel, like those really cheap hotels in near Washington Square Park.
Yeah,
that's really where he was crashing. I don't know about this sleeping in the park shit. Maybe he slept one time in the park, but Jean was very resourceful. He would not have to sleep in the park. He would hook up with either a woman or a man to have a place to sleep, and he could do that very easily.
Yeah.
So that's he wouldn't need to do that. Yeah. You know, he was too clever for that, and he was from a middle class family. He's not exactly, you know, like this comfortable in filth. Mm. So yeah. And but so I don't know about it. I mean, there's a lot of bullshit around Jean Michel. You know, mm-hmm. Jean Michel was a fallible human being. He was not this fucking, you know, like,
yeah, like
alien saint from fucking another planet. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a person who had insecurities and all kinds of issues. You know, and the fact that he was so fucking hung up on being famous is really what was his downfall, because, or anybody, it could be anybody's downfall, because if you're motivated by the reward, you forget what the fuck it is that you're doing. You know what I mean?
He needed to live longer to go through that understanding. He died too soon to, because you go through these trials and tribulations and you either fucking wake up or, you know, you put yourself to sleep, I guess, but... It's a shame. That's the worst part about it. I mean, he should have been able to go through those.
Right, because he was extremely
lived long enough.
Yeah, like, he was extremely intelligent, and it was unlucky that
brilliant.
Yeah, he was brilliant. But it's unlucky that he had that he didn't get past that, because I think he was starting to see that towards the end. I think he was starting to notice that this is not a happy life.
Well, I was with him the last months. It just happened to turn out that way, all because of Reg heard a conversation between me and John, and he said, why don't you help John out, you know, because he needed somebody to take care of him in a way. And I was a friend of his, so I said, sure. And I was there at the end, and it was very strange. It was very, very strange, because I had a sense of it a little bit, that like, there's something really weird. He's, like, not handling this very well, and I told Reg anyway. I don't want to get too much into it because it's. But someday I'll give it a whole.
Do you know anything
of it?
Do you know anything about that trip down to New Orleans?
Just before he died?
Yeah,
I thought
or
he
May.
Was Hawaii. Oh,
in May.
No, I'm not sure.
You just, know, just I was, out of curiosity.
Yeah, no.
People have asked about that. This picture with Kevin Bray and him and somebody else.
No,
and
that, I'm not sure.
The African guy.
Shenge?
No, not Shenge.
Tara.
Yeah, that guy. Yeah. Tara.
Yeah, they were friends. Right. I think he went to Africa with him.
Yeah, he did. I think the one time he went to Africa.
And his girlfriend went with him, John.
What was
her
name?
Glenn or no? Something Glenn. Do you remember? I can't remember.
Nah,
the name.
I have no idea.
not Jennifer's. Good.
It was her. No,
it was.
I don't know. I think so.
But there was this girl that had like a quasi Nordic name or something. I forgot.
Oh, you mean Iman?
Or
his roommate? Or he had her living in the basement, actually.
What was her name?
Iman was her last name, I believe.
Something
like that.
Yeah. He had her living in the basement?
Yeah, she was there.
She was like Quasimodo.
She was
like a man, like a Ford model Quasimodo.
Yeah. I met her.
So, talking about graffiti art in New York City.
The mayors that had these battles. Was it Koch? Was that the one?
Oh, it was Koch. Koch. It was a battle. It was a fucking war, a straight up war on graffiti, trying to. And he won it. More security on at the train yards and layups.
They changed the metal
surveillance. Harsher penalties. Quicker cleaning, which is discouraging because nobody could see their name anymore.
They changed the material on the exterior of the trains, right?
Well, they started, not material, but they started spraying like coatings on things so that the shit would beat up. And it was good. They were really spending some big money on cleaning the trains, like right quick. That's until in the 80s, the minute something got sprayed, they would just clean it and they would not run the train.
Wow.
In other words, it would not leave the layup. You know?
These opponents against graffiti equated with urban decay, right? I mean, that was
the broken windows theory. If something looks shoddy, people are not going to want to use it, and that was essentially the psychology there. So and of course. The ridership went up when the trains were cleaner, safer, more police. It was gonna happen eventually. Yeah. I mean, let's face it, graffiti is still illegal. You can't just go and spray paint or write on somebody's property. I mean, it's just would you let somebody just go spray paint your automobile or something?
Right.
So of course, that's just the nature of it.
Futura says it at the end of the Clash song. They blew 40 mil, they say, or something. The MT blew a certain amount of money to go after it.
Yeah, they blew a lot of money, and then they basically won a war. It was a war against graffiti, and it was very actively fought. It was for real.
Yeah.
With that intent, you know, we're gonna abolish this shit. Got to make it like push it back.
What's interesting is the Keith Haring thing. He did it illegally, but he also had like stuff.
But Keith was doing something different. He wasn't writing his name. You know, it wasn't letter form. It was he was making people smile, which is a different thing. You know, if he started out with chalk, you know, on the black when they blacked out the ad panels,
right.
So yes, he was appropriating public space. Yes, he was, he was doing something that was not without permission. It's definitely
like
against the law. So it was definitely a crossover.
Yeah.
Because it was no longer a name for him. Same thing with Samo. Samo is often described as a conceptual art graffiti because it was not a tag. It was a brand or product that a brand or a product that we were trying to create that didn't exist, but it was as an alternative to this, as an end to that, like
the
religion.
The crown.
No, the crown. That's Basquiat's crown.
Everybody was using a crown, but his
people have a crown.
Yeah,
but Samo never had a crown.
Samo
didn't have Jean-Michel
branded his
stuff with a crown, and people with the way information is proliferated, well, because there's a crown and because Jean-Michel is associated with Samo, they put the Samo on top of the crown and somehow you have the same people have said, oh, how about the Samo crown? And I say, there is no such a thing as a Samo thing. Because if you look at any photographs of old Samos, you're not going to see a crown.
Yeah.
It's not, doesn't exist. So, but, the cult of the cult of the personality, misinformation is abundant. There's no shortage of bullshit. Yeah.
But that was a decision between the two of you, right?
There was no, it wasn't even a conversation. Was, yeah, we just right. did, it was never, there was no crown. It was like, right. Oh, are we going to put a crown? No.
Well, you know, speaking of conversations in 1978 when SEMA was formed, you know, there's a lot of, there's so much information online about you and him coming up with the same
they got me in the fucking Times Square show too. So man.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's true. Yeah, I know. Right. No,
like this woman, woman sent me this thing that she wrote about street art. You know, and it's like, oh no, here we go, another street art article. And she goes, she's talking about Rag and Bone, that store over on Houston.
Yeah.
And they said some of the artists who we paid to do murals, and they had my name in there. And I was like, I don't even know who those people are, nor have I ever stepped foot in there. And somehow, where's the money you gave me for this mural? I'll go pick it up right now.
Damn. Yeah.
So it's just like,
make me too make, younger than I am.
Okay. Yeah.
I was born in
58. All
right.
Well,
58. Well, I was born
56. Really? Oh, you look good. 56. You're 3 years older than me. I'm 59.
Huh?
I was born in 59. I'm 63.
Wow.
Yeah, I was born in 1959.
Wow.
Castro.
John in 1960.
He was a year and a half younger than me. I'm June in 59. He's all the way at the end of 60. So that's a year and a half.
He was in December.
December 22nd. His birthday's coming up. He'll be, what, 61? 62?
All right. So no, you guys, 61. You guys were born and raised in New York City, and you witnessed and partook in well, I mean, actually, you weren't. You Rick Kroll wasn't writing on the walls.
No, I did a few things.
Did you?
They're on there. They're the documents.
You did some stencils? Is that what you did? Or?
No, I did some stuff at the piers, and then I did a few.
You did some stuff at the piers. All right.
Yeah, there's like nice images of them.
Because Aldo from Howell was asking why didn't we include piers, but we did. But it was because it was more street art.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we were trying to make that distinction in the show as opposed to. I mean, yes, street art was inspired by graffiti, obviously, because it was appropriating public space. And like I was describing the Keith Haring stuff.
Speaking of street art, we ran into Christopher Hart Chambers last weekend.
I saw Chambers yesterday.
Yeah, so with Avant, you know, Chris says that. Do you guys remember his?
I remember Avant. Yeah, sure.
Well, but you know, the other one is Hamilton.
Oh yeah,
Hamilton. Hamilton type. was a little more. I think more. He kind of made a prototype for street art in terms of like painting on the ground and stuff like that. What Avant was doing was they were taking pieces that they made in the studio and putting it out in public, which is a little bit different from going and making a piece on location. It's very different.
It was like a performance. Yeah. He did in secret. You
know. Well, he did the body outlines, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the first time I saw Hamilton. I saw
that photo one. I have eyes for you.
Right.
Like creepy.
And
stuff.
Then there was Shadow Man. That was
pretty
good. But he was. Remember the little umbrella, purple umbrella lady that sprayed around. There was a bunch of. Yeah. But there was a bunch of
being done for a while.
Yeah. But there was a bunch of people that were doing, and some of it was early stencil work.
I'm trying to remember.
But Hamilton was doing real, like, I mean, what I think is he laid a template for that type of work, where it's on location. It's not you're drawing something and then go wheat paste it up, which is what Avant was doing. You know, it's very different. It's a different thing. You're executing it there on the spot. You know,
his work was perfectly calibrated for that because it was that silhouette. It was
right.
Like, he could knock it out like boom. It's
right. It was exactly. Remember that guy who was doing that homage to him, and he did like 25. And here in New York.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, that guy. What was that guy's name? A guy who came to New York like 2 years ago.
Oh, I know. Monty.
Not Monty. Monty. Well, Monty wrote that book.
Yeah.
No, there was a guy, a young man from.
Oh, I know.
From out west.
About. I don't know the
he's
guy.
Like a, he's like some name. Sort of like he's like a mountain bike champion.
And he did a homage.
And he did. He was doing Hamilton homages, like these, the new improved Shadow Man, and people were, and he got an article in the New York. They even contacted me and they asked me what I thought about the guy, and I was like, well, it's, you know, I thought it was excessive to put so much energy into an homage. Right. I could see one or two, but if you're doing like you know, like he went to like 15 cities and
it's
did this.
Gimmicky.
It's gimmicky. It's way gimmicky. It's like, dude, I think that's the word. You really, really into Hamilton, you know?
It's like a stone.
It's like you want to be him, you know? Yeah. It's like you need to like get a really bad drug habit and like fucking like whatever. But it seemed a little upset, like not a lot obsessive, not a little.
You kind of put yourself in a corner.
It's like, it gets weird. So I said,
I wouldn't like somebody to do that about me, though.
Yeah, right?
Oh, I do these or Al
Diaz. Yeah, it gets a little creepy. It's a little fucking creepy. It's like some kind of stalker or something.
So from trains to roll gates and walls, the 90s, is that when they started using that, like the fire extinguisher?
I think like, maybe a little later than that. I think those,
what was that about?
They have these pressure. It's like what exterminators use, you know? It's like a pump, you know? It's a tank.
Clean stuff?
To spray paint. Wow. Yeah, to spray paint. In that show, at 250, there's an example of a guy using it in a Berlin. He's doing a smiley face.
Yeah.
Big fucking smiley face. Like 20 feet wide kind of shit. And it's like spraying it with this. It's basically when the guys come to kill the roaches
in the 70s. Was there a connection with the advancement of spray paint and the medium? Like, was it? I mean, it was available. Was there something like
it's that, become? Like, it's become like. Yeah, there's like technology.
Did they
like
that in the 50s or 40s or
30s? No. Like, we made our own fat caps. Like we would go in the supermarket and steal the tops off the Gifoam oven cleaner Niagara spray starch because it had a really big spread.
Right.
But that's I don't know who figured that out.
Yeah.
But we all, you know, word of mouth, you find out about the shit, and it's like, oh, you got to do this. But now they have factory made different size nozzles to spray for anything from, you know, a thin line to a very thick line, you know.
There's more colors, right?
Oh shit. There's like 100,000 times more colors. I mean, it was like the basic kind of like, you know, except for Krylon. Krylon was the first company to come out with the custom colors. Like they would have like a school bus yellow. And
yeah, Lee Canonis was telling me about that.
He came in a little later from my generation, and by then like people like Crash and those guys, they were already taking it to the next refinement, you know. That class of, as a matter of fact, the 17th, which is next Saturday, I think we have a talk in the afternoon with Lee, Crash, Dave Chino, who is one of the people who worked at Beyond the Streets, and Carlo McCormick is gonna facilitate a discussion on the mainstreaming of graffiti. And it was that generation of guys and that type of people who were more savvy, they just had a little more on the ball than a lot of the guys from my generation did, and they were able to really take graffiti and make it more commercially viable, you know.
Futura too, right?
And Futura, of course. Futura has a piece. I just added a Futura piece to the 250 show. Yeah, but Futura is another really perfect example of that. Those people who stepped it up, you know. It didn't just end with. See, the problem, you know, I have with a lot of older graffiti guys from my generation is that, you know, some people think it ended there. You know, anything that came, it's like this. It's like, oh, graffiti died. But, you know, as soon as you quit, it's no longer. But the truth is that it's
anything about?
Oh, what's that?
Is that an, kind of envy?
I think it's all that. It's bitterness. It's just, you know, it's just like, you know, it's like, you don't want to root for the young, you know, you need to pass the baton, no, with anything.
Like Lady Pink is in there.
Lady Pink came later too, but she was you know, because she was not the first woman writer. She's part of that group of people. Definitely, I would put her
Fashion Moto.
Fashion Moto, yeah.
Yeah. Remember that crash painting at the outside of it, or was that Lee?
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
I think, I forgot, it might have been a Lee piece.
Yeah.
All right, so people describe the streets in New York City during the pandemic, 2020, 2021, as an explosion of
lawlessness,
lawlessness, and a lot of artists coming out.
It's
just
true.
Taking
it
advantage
is true.
Of it all.
All.
Was it was well, 2020, 2021, like the lockdown?
2020
during lockdown.
Was during the lockdown. There was a lot of I know.
Is it comparable to the amount of graffiti that was on in this or street art and graffiti from the 70s and 80s
on
or?
The subways? That because the subways were so heavily covered in the 70s. The pandemic produced a lot of street graffiti that was comparable in volume to the 70s subway graffiti because all those store gates and everything, there
was
all, everything
it, right?
was
all,
covered
all,
and like people
covered,
doing rooftops everywhere. The city becomes this like, it's not so much the subways anymore. Mm-hmm. It's because it's such a difficult target.
Yeah.
It seems like the only graffiti in the subways like that's graffito stuff, right? Or scratching on the glass.
Well, that and tags on tile. Tags on tile, but very few tags on the trains because their penalties are harsh. There's a lot of surveillance.
It's not worth it, right?
And it's not, for me, it's not. The only guys, these guys come from Europe and they fucking they end up dying and shit like that. But they have commando
teams. There were a lot of tourists. There were a lot of tourists coming here.
It is fucking crazy. That's why.
I guess it's an honor for them.
They get like, yo, we must go to New York, you know?
Yeah.
And it's fucking, and then like, and they end up on the fucking cover of the Post, you know? I mean, it's fucking nuts. But they do. They come in like commando teams with like special gear and anti-surveillance equipment, and then the train never fucking makes it to the, because as soon as it gets painted, the MTA says that's not going out. Mm-hmm. So you better take some. So the only
You're
place you see it
the party is where it is.
That too. Okay, I'm with that. It's like you guys are a bit late to the party.
I mean, I guess it's a compliment. I mean, they're just.
But it's
they,
like,
they
yeah,
idol,
okay.
They
well,
they,
well, that's that it is for that. For, that's one of the reasons that the City of Kings exhibit is legitimate, because the fact is that everyone emulates New York when it comes to graffiti.
Yeah.
We are the prototype for the entire globe. I was just in Toronto about a month and a half ago, and it's like they have homages to iconic New York City graffiti personalities. Mm. It's like, oh shit, there's like a Case 2 a memorial there, and he probably never went there. So, but it's just like, you know, they're like, oh, you know, and every style that you see looks like some shit that was originated in New York. You know, I mean, not everything, but the bulk of it. So the truth is that New York set the standard for it, you know.
Okay, so switching I'm guessing they're millennials, maybe there's some Generation X mixed in, but the oil protesters hitting up the Ferraris, you know, Ferrari like showcase, you know,
like the Klimt and the
museums,
whatever, and
the yeah museums. Like they're protest, yeah. Yeah,
but not, and none of that, none of those works, none of those works were ruined. So
right, they were covered.
They're like covered in glass. So,
but I mean, what are your thoughts on people just trying to get attention? They are getting attention for their cause.
It's kind of a stupid target. I think it's kind of pointless.
If I saw them do it,
Yeah, I was like, why would you do something so? It's like you're. It's so mis. It's yeah. I mean, why don't you do something to like an oil refinery? Grow a set of balls. You want to do some shit? Go fucking not into an art museum. What the fuck is kind of target is that? Terrific. If you go show some fucking balls, literally, and do some shit that might get you machine gunned, not like knocked down by a fucking art guard who's like 72. Yeah. You know, his part time job type shit. It's like that's my uncle, right? Yeah. It's like, that to me is really tepid, flaccid activism. You know, it's like totally really. Great. Yeah, it's weak. It's weak.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of contradictions that exist within the materials they're using. To stop big oil anyway. I mean, with like the
tomatoes, awesome.
Well, and sometimes they're using some like oil-based paint or like that's their
funny
backpacks
though.
And their
sneakers. Fucking, or you know, Campbell's soup on the Warhol. Yeah, that's funny. Like, it's stupid, but it's fucking. It's kind of appropriate.
Is what it is.
I know. I mean, that's a lot of energy that you could put into doing planning and executing that. I mean, you can make something really kind of good.
I guess if I was
if you use that, if you take all those calories and fucking energy and put it into something productive, you can do something much more effective.
Okay.
Maybe they should raise the penalties for these knuckleheads, like really through the roof.
Through the roof. Cut it like out. They hit the guillotine.
The spot.
Well, it made me think of you reintroduced SAMO, the tag SAMO. Was it during the Trump administration?
The day after the election, the results were announced. Uh-huh. I was like, this is fucking crazy. We got this. How the fuck did that happen? Yeah. So, and I had been doing, my signage, which is, which is constrained writing. And there's only, when you don't have a full alphabet, you can't really, you can't really say things straightforwardly. Mm-hmm. So I was like, and it combined with the fact that I was really tired of this whole, like, this misconstrued thing, like SAMO was Jean-Michel's bus tag or his nickname or something, and it was a good combination of reasons to bring it back so that I could one say things about like this what I felt about like this whole Trump thing, and two to give an entire generation a true example of what a SAMO actually was.
Yeah.
And at first I received a lot of like, why are you writing Basquiat's tag? Like people in tears, like, we're gonna sue you. Like, this, oh yeah, I said, like, you have that got to see the fucking text
is that expected?
I mean, yeah, I guess. But there was one, I received some fucking shit that was hilarious, man. This one woman was like, you're writing Basquiat's tag. That's, you can't do that. Wow. And she goes, and she, what would she say? She goes, what the hell is it? I met Pat Fields once. I know. I was like, what the fuck? She met Pat Fields once. Wow. So she was an expert on saying, hey, I mean, it was like stuff like that. So people are like, oh, now you're like getting on, trying to ride on Basquiat's tail or some shit.
But that was like, the initial response.
That was the initial response, right. For like a year.
Yeah, but what you did you did that show when was Basquiat's like they did a show at Basquiat's studio, right? And
right, I did a show. I did a show.
What year was that? 2017.
It was because the space that was in 2018. Okay. It was the 30th anniversary of his.
I think that's when I was like. Yeah, like SAMO and Al Diaz, and I kind of, that's kind of like when I learned about you more.
It was purposely done for that. I was with Adrian Wilson, who I no longer associate with because he turned out to be somebody who I didn't, our relationship was not very productive. We together got the idea to to do a tribute for the 30th anniversary. And then Adrian later, and we did. They said that they would turn a blind eye, that they're not supposed to okay something like that because it's a landmark building, et cetera, et cetera. So I did it anyway. I had like five people with me, and it was July. Oh no, it was August. It was his anniversary for his 30th death. So it was August, and it was a hot day. And I just, you know, I mean, I had some stuff printed up, and I pasted it on there. And everyone, you know, we just hung out. It was like an afternoon on sidewalk beach, you know, and we were just hanging there, and it was fun. What's that, Great Jones? Yeah. So I did the. I did not sign up to be a face for something products or something. It was, mm-hmm. And then across the street was it like a Basquiat? It's funny that they put it there, but there was like this kind of Basquiat looking guy drinking Avion water. Oh, man. So it was like a conversation with that sign, and it stayed there for a long time. That's what you see when they did the B-roll for the Warhol diaries, and they showed the front of that space. They show that it's like all my letters are there. Oh, okay. Anyway, that was what was left of it by then. But I kind of went off the point. I was trying to describe. I couldn't write things clearly without a full alphabet. So, and it was
how did it feel after years of
I got more and more into it. At first it was a little awkward. It was like like strange. But I was like, oh man, this is like so old, but it was new. So then I got into a groove. I did it for until February of 2019 when I got caught, or some cleaning lady or MTA cleaning lady went over. She was sussing me out because she had seen me before, and apparently the MTA had put out a warrant for me.
Okay.
After this, but they were telling the cleaning people on the R line to keep an eye for the same old guy, and she followed me, and she didn't see me writing, but she went over to the ink and it was wet, and then she tried to take a picture. I was with Mariah, and we like fucking ran out of the station, and I don't know, maybe like 2 weeks later, I get a call.
Wow.
I get a call from the New York City the citywide vandal squad.
Oh, wow.
I was like, get out of here. Yeah, I thought it was somebody joking.
Yeah.
But they got my number. Surveillance is a motherfucker. But the thing is that they could have easily gone to one of my shows and like acted like a graffiti guy, and I gave them my card, and that's how they got my number. They fucking called me on my cell phone. Hmm. And I was there with Dave Navarro was there with me because we were signing a series of prints that we did together. And Brian Hamill, a printer I work with, and I was like, oh shit, and they're like, what happened? And I was like, I mean, I had fucking butterflies, you know, holy shit, is it for real? Is it somebody fucking prank? And sure enough, I tried to turn a blind eye to it, and they said you can come, we can give you a DAT if you come to the you'll get a fine. If you come to the local precinct,
DAT,
the desk appearance ticket, so you don't get locked up. So and then I went. I ended up going to Puerto Rico, and I was back maybe four weeks. Another month had passed, and they said, "Listen, dude, you never showed up. You fucking blocked the phone." And they called me on another phone, and I said, "We got a warrant for you now. You got to come in." So I had to show up. It was very real. I had to show up 5:30 in the morning to my local precinct because the citywide task force does not have a precinct. They have to arrest you at your closest precinct.
Wow.
So I went there. They cuffed me. They took me to fucking Brooklyn detention and to the criminal court. And I had to pay a criminal lawyer because I had to get out of this. I was not going to use a fucking, what do they call it? Pro bono. Pro bono. Yeah, but you know the court.
Attorneys.
And it cost me a little money, and but I got off scot-free 100%.
Right.
The judge was, I mean, the lawyer I got through a good friend who's people who other lawyers had been ADA at that same court, so he knew everybody in the fucking. They all know each other. They go to fucking lunch together, like you know, after they have arguments for you know.
So there's no record.
It was expunged after 6 months. She said, like, stay out of trouble.
What that day that you got caught, was that a marker?
Yeah, it was mostly marker that I did. It was just messages on the subway. This time it was on the subway because the original same ones were on mostly on the street. It was not really a subway project. It was a street project.
So that was like 2019 then,
okay. So 2019, I started it in late 2016 and early 2019, I had to cool it. They were like, dude, just, you know, stop.
Yeah.
And that was it. And then after that, but I in the meantime, I had been going around the states to different cities and putting same old, you know. At this point, the only corner I haven't hit was the North Pacific. Like Seattle and those places.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't mind doing that, having a reason to go out there.
Right.
I went to Indiana. I went to Miami a few times, but
Texas.
I had a show in Texas. I don't know if I did it. Did
Rick,
anything.
You're going out to Oregon next month.
Austin. Yeah. I did some stuff in Austin, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got Texas.
And you were in New Orleans a couple weeks ago, too?
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I think like do we have let's see. I think we got a lot of we covered a lot of stuff and it's about 49 minutes, so I think we're good. What was that Dave Navarro project? I think I saw that on your
Dave, I just talked to Dave. He took an interest in me because of he saw Sarah Driver's film and he got this sense like, oh, cuz he had a similar thing with the Chili Peppers. Like, you know, like the odd man out kind of thing. And he could relate to like me talking about Jean-Michel or Kenny Sharp saying all of a sudden, you know, it was just,
I mean, he curated some visual artists for like a music festival or something that you were in. Was that, am I correct about that? Or
no, we did some actual visual art collaboration.
Oh, okay.
He wanted to explore visual art and was kind of trepidatious about it because he thought he was going to be judged because he was like, oh, this, the fucking rock star is right. Trying to be like,
crossover.
You know, like,
yeah.
But he's done some cool stuff and we did some good stuff together. And
where can we see, is that online or?
I would imagine, yeah. It's probably on my Instagram. It's on, there's more like 2018 was a year, 2019 we did stuff, 2020 even. We did about three projects together.
Were you ever
Prince.
A Addiction fan? Or
a
little bit.
Right.
It's
I like Einstürzende Neubauten.
Oh, you like that? Yeah, industrial.
Yeah, they were great.
Yeah.
He's still good with Bardo.
Still around, right?
Yeah,
I still see people that crazy symbol with the little, he looks like a cave drawing guy. That symbol became like almost like just iconic, you know, like just because it's a cool looking logo.
Yeah.
That's really important for people to have a good logo.
That's true.
Yeah, maybe those are good words of wisdom. And yeah.
The branding, of course. Yeah. I mean, you know.
So we're gonna wrap it up. Thank you to Al Diaz, Rick Kroll.
Thanks,
thank you guys. Thank you.
Give a shout out to Lee Wells for giving us the access to the IFAC facility, and thanks to Christina and Nicola for introducing me to Al, and Al, you know, come visiting the project space on 21st Street, Brian Leo Projects, and thanks to Noah from White Hot Magazine.
Thanks, Noah.
Thank you, Noah.
All right, so have a great day.